social disorder. So you're not just treating one aspect of a person's life, you're treating actually three of them. So, you know, when I realized that there was so much more to this that needed to be impacted, and when I really understood that and got the proper services, then I was able to recover. I have over 21 years of consistent recovery from drugs and alcohol. I just celebrated my 21st anniversary, March 10th. People that see me in meetings and do presentations, the first thing I say is I'm loud and proud to be a man in recovery from mental illness and drug addiction. And the reason why is because it killed my mother and it killed my sister and it tried to kill me. And once you understand this illness and understand how to address it and do those things necessary, then recovery is possible and there's hope.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What are the numbers in the prison system of people with dual diagnosis?
The numbers are, it's challenging to talk about the numbers. There's a high need for people with substance abuse to be having their mental illness addressed. Over half the people incarcerated have a mental illness condition, and over 80% have a substance abuse or addictions issue. And when we say mentally ill, we're not always talking about diagnosed, but having problems associated. And I can give you a perfect example. Is I do the orientations in the intake centers at Coffee Creek is where the men who are incarcerated and sentenced to go into the state institutions are funneled through their intake center. And up until last year, we were holding orientations once a month in two locations at Coffee Creek. And the men would sign up to come to my orientation just to get out of their cells. I mean, anytime you can sign up to be in a program to get out of your cells, and then they do it. It's not always because they want to. But what's interesting about this is that there would be anywhere from 25 to 50 men that would sign up and attend my hour group, and we would talk about the reasons why they were in prison. And my focus was primarily to educate them to understand that if they had been incarcerated more than once, which I would get at least 70% of the people raising their hands that stated that, that they probably suffered from a mental illness. Because according to a personality disorder, which is called antisocial behavior, is a reason why people are consistently incarcerated. And if you look at 80% of the people incarcerated also suffer from a substance abuse and addiction issue, and you got 70% of them saying that they've been incarcerated more than once, at least in my orientations, then you do the math. I mean, there's a combination of both going on here. And so you would think that people would recognize and understand that they both need to be addressed.
So, Doyle, you worked in the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, which is in Wilsonville. That is the intake, and it is also the only women's prison in Oregon. Talk about the work that you did with the women at Coffee Creek.
When I was doing Coffee Creek, I was doing a meeting in the women's unit that people were attending, coming out of Turning Point, Pathfinders, and Lift program. And they were doing it on a Friday night during family visits and yard time, which I never thought we'd get very much of a turnout. Now, if you understand that all these programs only hold 50 people in each program, I was, as a volunteer, doing a group on a Friday night during yard and visits, getting as many as 37 women to attend my group. The women would attend the DDA meetings and learn from other women when they suffered from mental illness of depression, anxiety, race brain. Sometimes it was more severe in terms of bipolar and manic depression and schizophrenia. Some women wouldn't identify with that until they heard it and understood that it applied to them. And they didn't see it as a mental illness. Primarily, you'll find out women in addiction that are incarcerated, a large, and I don't want to give a percentage, but a large or majority of them suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and a lot of abuse issues, a lot of, you know, crimes against them sexually. And when you understand why somebody doesn't recover from addiction is because they're not addressing their primary issues. And it's a mental disorder when you're constantly being affected by something that's you can't let go of. And when you have a peer-to-peer support which talks about the importance of, and we're not pro and we're not anti-medications, but when you see the importance of working with your clinician, your prescriber, taking medications as prescribed, and working with a support group that identifies and targets, I call it targeting the problem areas, then you see a bigger success rate. You know, it's not a rocket science. It really, you know, when we talk about what AA did and what or does, and we talk about what Narcotics Anonymous or NA does, or Cocaine Anonymous or Al-Anon or Alanteen, DDA is commonly known as a 12-step plus 5 program. We've customized and got permission from Alcoholics Anonymous to customize the 12 steps of AA and combine them with 5 steps of DDA, which is addressing the mental health, which seems to be the missing link.
And do people entering the prison system in Oregon, do they self-report that they have a mental illness or an addiction? Yeah. How is that done?
Yeah, and this is some of the challenges, and that's a very good question, because Behavioral Health Services is who they have to notify in order to request to attend a dual diagnosis anonymous meeting. Unless they are professionally diagnosed and being treated, they're not even able to be put on the call outs to attend our groups.
So they have to be diagnosed prior to coming to prison?
During their process of being in the intake center, and or if they have prior incarcerations, they'll show if they suffer from mental illness. But yes, I mean, it's very unfortunate because we have so many people wanting to attend our meetings but can't because of the due process and also the size.
Within the prison system, we are treating a handful of people.
Right. When we were cut, we were approximately providing service to about 200 people.
And according to the Department of Corrections website, Doyle, they have substance abuse treatment programs. They don't list DDA programs.
Yeah, for my 13 years plus experience working in Columbia River Correction Institution, the mental health piece is very limited. You know, they do cognitive classes. They do what they call strategies for self-improvement change. They have moral recognition therapy. They have dialectical behavioral therapy. The addiction piece has a little bit more programming associated with it, but mental health is normally done through treatment of medications and or placed in cognitive groups. There's not a lot of programs for them, no.
So you had meetings in Coffee Creek and meetings in Columbia River. Talk about those meetings.
When the people attend the meetings inside the prisons, they share their experience, strength, and hopes, weakness, feelings, and fears of what's happened to them prior to coming into the prisons and why they're in the prisons. In the medium prison, they more or less talk about the dynamics of being locked up and how they're dealing with their mental illnesses. When you get into minimum, it's more about reintegration back out into society and being scared to be with their family and or how they were going to be able to do things that they didn't really have a clear answer to. So the support was hugely necessary. And what I seen was that there, and it's our mission, is to provide hope to those that suffer. They seen hope. They really did see hope. And the reason why they seen hope was because there was a process that happened with the literature that we use and the meeting format. Is it gives them an ability to have crosstalk. They literally process things with a basically rules of respect. They can't talk over each other. They can't interrupt each other. And when questions and answers are asked for and they give permission to be given, then they get feedback on terms of what medications, side effects, you know, support groups, you know, resources, that type of thing, in terms of what they're getting out of this group. And its primarily function is to address their mental health issues along with their addiction issues. And when they recognize that it's the missing link, that it's really the thing that keeps making them relapse. And Corbett's fond of saying that if you've relapsed a number of times, then you're probably a DDAer. You know, if you tried treatment, tried traditional 12 steps and you can't make it, try a DDA meeting and you'll understand the difference. And it really does help. People that come to the meetings, I constantly hear, why haven't I heard this before? This is the missing link. We've actually partnered with Pacific University and Dartmouth University that did focus groups. And they did them in the prisons. They did them in the Oregon State hospitals. And we did them outside in Iron Tribe houses and other locations. And they're actually combining all that information and analyzing it, and it's going to be published by Dartmouth University and Sean Roush of Pacific University with Dr. Robert Drake and Sean Roush. And we're very proud of that. And I sat on some of these focus groups, and the women in the prisons and the men at Columbia River, according to Sean Roush and his occupational therapist facilitators, were highly impacted and affected by the people in prisons and what they were saying that DDA was helping them with. And they were all crying sometimes and saying that it was the missing link. It was the missing link. It was the missing link. And it was a place they felt comfortable and safe to be able to process and talk and understand how to address their mental health issues along with their addiction issues.
And Doyle, what about stigma? The stigma of mental illness, especially in prison.
The stigma behind mental illness in the prison prevents people from receiving the help that they need. They get ridiculed and made fun of, especially when they're standing in lines to get their medications. And they even make fun of themselves so they can fit in. You know, I was even afraid to admit that I had a mental illness. We don't even associate ourselves as mentally ill. We suffer from a mental illness, which we don't even like the labeling. It's just that we have to identify what's happening so we can address it. And once you address the problem areas, then you have hope.
So talk about reentry and the need for someone who is dually diagnosed as they release from prison.
Yeah, it's been my experience as an alcohol and drug counselor and transition counselor in the Oregon State Prison System at Columbia River Correction Institution, that the release or reentry with mental health is lacking. They give them a 30-day prescription, which sometimes is filled or not filled, is responsible to be picked up when they leave. Not always is it left in their, I don't know what you'd call it. When an inmate is released, they have a packet at control. And if their medications are not in it, I've literally watched them have to come back to the gate and get told that they have to wait for it to be sent to a prescriber in order to be picked up, even if they just turned around and walked back to the gate because it wasn't put in their release packet. And also parole and probation is responsible for following up with their mental health needs if they don't go through treatment, which I've seen have lots of difficulties. What seems to work best is when mentors or outreach specialists are working on the inside with them and advocating with them and making sure that they pick them up or meet with them outside the first day of their release and make sure all that stuff is in order so they don't have any problems associated with their mental health issues and or addiction issues. And it seems to be more effective than just relying on the inmate in the release process. DOC recognizes the importance with addictions to use wraparound services with reentry, with Bridges to Change, Iron Tribe, and some other Oxford houses and things of that nature for the housing piece. Bridges to Change, which actually has mentors that come in to the prison, and they pretty much work with the release counselors and me as a transition counselor. I would have them do presentations, and what we would do is understand a client's consumer or offender's needs and make sure that they had the things that would be helpful for them. And DOC knows that if a person in custody does not have housing, does not have support, and does not have some financial support or employment, that they're at high risk of reoffending. Okay. Then you include the mental health and addictions. Okay. And they have what they call an ACRE score, a criminogenics risk factor score, which is what I think the Oregon accountability model is based on. They're ethically and competently supposed to affect those and target those problem areas. Most people don't get life sentences. They come out and they're going to either recover or reoffend. And it's so important to support these guys in a way to where they understand what they need to do. The percentages are astronomical in terms of what the need is, and what's given in terms of funding does not outweigh the need. And, you know, and DDA, it really is a cost-effective way in order to help address these needs.
Talk about the costs, Doyle.
Well, according to our literature, it's about $3 a person when you put it in perspective with contracts, opposed to $3,000 a person. The $3 is what it means is when we have contracts is what it costs, you know, the DDA office for overhead, for salaries, for literature, when you talk about 3,000 people we serve and how much money we get in terms of funding, you know, we're connecting it to about $3 a person, which is, you know, they have what they call a coordinated care organizations in the state of Oregon right now, which has a triple aim, and we fit that model really well in terms of, you know, being cost effective. And, you know, we do a lot for a little organization in terms of how many people we serve. We try to be in the places where the biggest need is, and it's the psych wards, hospitalizations, the treatment programs, the county jails, and the prisons.
The need is so great. Why would the Oregon Department of Corrections discontinue DDA in the prison system?
There was new management funding issues, and that's what happens in DOC when there's a funding crisis. If they don't know much about your program, they're going to end it if there's no more money.
If anything, this should be in every prison instead of being cut at this point.
Our hope is to meet with the management of the Department of Corrections and reorientate them for the need of DDA and how effective it was in the history. My hope is that once they realize what they canceled, they will re-implement the program.
How do you get your funding, and how can people help with this?
We get our funding through contracts and grants, donations. We have a webpage where there's a PayPal. People can donate, and it shows where your money goes, what it connects to in terms of how we pay outreach specialists, how we provide trainings, how we have an office, that type of thing. We have right now currently 7 contracts that fund us, but again, we receive donations. We do fundraisers. We're hoping to develop different ways of raising money, and it's dependent on those contracts in order to be able to provide services for people that suffer from mental illness and addictions. We just got funded by Max Williams and the Oregon Community Foundation. Now, if you know who Max Williams is, he was the director of the Oregon State Corrections. Now the director is Collette Peters. It used to be Max Williams. He oversees an organization called the Oregon Community Foundation. And we met with him and submitted a grant for a new program that we wanted to get started called the Family Support Network, which, if you understand how Al-Anon and Al-Anon works, this is similar, but for families that are affected by people that suffer from substance abuse and mental health conditions. And we received a $20,000 grant.
So this program is for family members of people with dual diagnosis.
Exactly. Which is a high need too. And we hear that all the time from consumers that come to our groups, that my family doesn't understand me. They just keep telling me to stop it. I can't stop it. You guys understand me better than my family. So when we hear stuff like this, we understand the need that there needs to be education and support for people, because mental illness isn't just a one-person illness. It affects everybody, especially the family. And if anything, the family dynamics contribute to the risk factors when somebody is trying to recover if they're not doing something to help. We're in the process of establishing 5 family support network meetings. And you can go on the Dual Diagnosis Anonymous webpage and see what we're about. And you can also contact our office if you're interested in those.
And what is that contact information?
Well, the contact information in terms of the phone number for DDA is 503-222-6484. The website is DualDiagnosisAnonymousOfOregon.com.
And how many people that you connect with in prison continue with DDA out here in the community?
There's a significant amount of people that attend our meetings after they leave the prisons and have also gotten started DDA meetings in their counties because there were none. Corbett was fond of saying that a quarter of the groups initially and when it was started were started by inmates coming out of the state Oregon prison system.
Now, Corbett Monica was the founder of DDA of Oregon, and he retired last year in 2013.
Yes, Corbett Monica is the founder. He will be utilized as the founder of the face of DDA. He's a legacy. He's a mentor. He's a spiritual guru. Anybody that's met Corbett loves Corbett. You walk around in a day in Corbett's shoes, and you'll love the world. I guarantee it. He also suffers from mental illness and addictions. He's a Vietnam vet, and he started DDA on a whim. It was because people that suffer from mental illness was addressing their issues by attending 12-step meetings and got kicked out of a 12-step meeting in 1996 in Fontana, California, which is what inspired him to do something. It wasn't to start DDA, it was because there was a need. And since then, it's real obvious that there's a need, or we wouldn't be in 32 of the 36 counties and across the United States and international. And so Corbett Monica is going to be, and is, in my mind, a legacy. You compare Dr. Bob and Bill W. of AA now today, and you think of them as a legacy. DDA is not going away, and the founder is going to be recognized for what he did in the future. He's writing a book. There's been articles written on us. We've received awards. You know, and we're just trying to do one thing and one thing only, is provide hope to those that suffer from mental illness and addictions. And it seems to be very effective in working for a lot of people, or they wouldn't want it so much.
Doyle, do you want to give your website one more time?
Yes, our website is DualDiagnosisAnonymousOfOregon.com. We also have a Facebook, which is Dual Diagnosis Anonymous of Oregon, which you can like and see the events and pictures and what people are saying about what they're receiving from DDA. It's kind of fun.
So, Doyle, congratulations on becoming Executive Director of DDA of Oregon.
Thank you, Karen.
And best of luck. And any final words?
What I'd like to say to people out there that suffer from addiction, that might not understand their mental illness, come check out a DDA meeting, and you might be surprised of the type of help that you can get. I'm loud and proud to be a man in recovery from addiction and mental illness, and I love to help people.
Thank you so much, Doyle.
Thank you, Karen.
You have been listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineer, Danielle Parks. Good night.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sold Out Music Festival, happening now until April 20th at venues all over Portland. The Sold Out Music Fest seeks to bring together people of all generations and backgrounds to celebrate the music that helps to bind our collective culture together. Legends of New Orleans jazz, the luminaries of Brooklyn hip-hop, the queen of modern soul music, and more are performing together under one banner. Bands, venues, bios, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And it is 7 o'clock p.m., Monday, April 14th, 2014. Coming up next on KBOO Portland, it's our evening broadcast of Hard Knock Radio, so stay tuned.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Everybody, welcome to another edition. It is Hard Knock Radio. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. On today's show, we cover the rallies and interview the people that were there dealing with the protest about fusion centers and suspicious activity reports. Later on, we're going to be talking with Daruba Bin Wahad, former political prisoner, about the link between COINTELPRO back in the days and the NSA domestic spying that goes on now. All that and more coming up.
Yeah, what's really going on? This is Boost from the Coup with Hard Knock Radio. You gotta be there.
What up, y'all? It's Aya Sage, a.k.a. Rocky Rivera, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Last week, there were a number of rallies all over the country to demand an end and a defunding to fusion centers, which are a primary vehicle in the ongoing domestic spying saga that all of us are dealing with. Here in the Bay Area, rallies were held in San Francisco and in Oakland. We attended both of them. What you're going to hear are excerpts from those two rallies. They involve folks from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, it involves people from Critical Resistance, it involves people who are advocates, privacy advocates, and a number of other organizations. Without further ado, we're going to let you hear the definition of fusion centers, suspicious activity reports, which all of us should be paying attention to, and the demands that they are asking for. Later on, we're going to hear from political prisoner and former Black Panther BLA member, Daruba Bin-Wahad, who connects the dots between what is going on in communities of color, what has traditionally happened in the past with COINTELPRO, and how it relates to the ongoing domestic spying that we're dealing with today. So let's take it away with Nordia from the Electronic Frontier Foundation as she breaks some of this stuff down.
My name is Nadia. I am an activist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And so basically, fusion centers are local, state, federal collaborations that exist to aid in information sharing. So they're actual physical locations where there's equipment, there's staff. And since we're in Oakland, I should mention that Oakland had staffing agreements with the Northern California Regional Intelligence Center. So Oakland Police Department and Oakland Fire Department were staffing that. So these centers allow bidirectional information sharing. That means that local law enforcement can share information with federal agencies, and federal agencies can share information with local law enforcement. When I talk about federal agencies, I'm talking about the 17 agency intelligence community. That's actually the phrase they use for themselves, which is a little bit, I don't know what your definition of a community is, but that's not my definition of a community. And this intelligence community is coordinated by the National Counterterrorism Center. So one of the reasons why EFF is here is because the National Counterterrorism Center was one of the four agencies that recently the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court allowed the NSA to share unminimized data with. So what that means is this is the raw data that the NSA is collecting. And it hasn't, you know, there's none of the personal information has been taken out. It hasn't gone through any of their much touted legal processes. And what that could potentially mean is that local law enforcement through fusion centers is actually getting unminimized data. We think that's incredibly concerning. So that's a little bit about what fusion centers do and who they're staffed by. Of course, they get their money from the federal government. They also get their money from the state and local government. As I mentioned, we know that local law enforcement is staffing them. And what they do, so they collect this information, they share it with the federal government, they produce intelligence reports. But one of the things that we're most concerned about is something called suspicious activity reporting. So this is a process where, how many people here have seen the see something, say something signs anywhere? Yeah, so most people have seen those. So when you... Not you, I'm hoping. But when people call in tips to see something, say something, they're generally going to fusion centers. And they are the basis most of the time for a suspicious activity report. So this is, it can be done by a civilian, it can be done by law enforcement, and it goes to the fusion center, and local law enforcement is then sent out to investigate it. So what does that mean? It gives the police another excuse to harass people. And so who are police going to be harassing? Well, they're going to be harassing who they are already harassing. That's going to be black and brown communities. It's going to be political activists. It's going to be poor folks. And that's what we're seeing with suspicious activity reports. So I just want to give you a couple of numbers. In Los Angeles, the group down there that's coordinating a day of action, the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition, they did a people's audit of suspicious activity reports that they got through PRAs, Public Records Act requests. And they found that 78% of these suspicious activity reports were done on non-whites. I don't think anybody here is probably surprised, but I think you need to hear that number. The other number I wanted to give you is that from the federal government, this year, there's $400 million in grants that is approved to fund these suspicious to fund fusion centers, and that's with the goal of standardizing suspicious activity reports. So, we know that fusion centers are being used to help harass people, and particularly in the Bay Area, something I mentioned this morning, and I want to mention again today. We are in a state in our communities that rapid gentrification is happening. We already know that people are moving into neighborhoods and they're calling the police on their neighbors. They're not moving in and making friends with their neighbors and being part of the community. They're moving in and they're calling the cops on the kids next door, and sometimes with really tragic consequences. So in San Francisco, the San Francisco Police Department shot and killed an unarmed young man while he was in a park hanging out before he had to go to work. Somebody called because they thought he was suspicious, and I think we can probably guess that part of the reason they thought he was suspicious is because he was a young man of color. So this is the kind of thing that suspicious activity reports is encouraging. It's encouraging the war on drugs. It's targeting people who are already targeted, and it's invading everybody's privacy. You know, the local, state, and federal law enforcement are collecting a vast trove of information on everybody. The demands that this coalition that is having events all over the country today are making are shut down the fusion centers, defund the fusion centers, and release all the secret files. And, you know, people at every step of the way have received opposition when they've tried to file Public Records Act requests. So we really support releasing all these files, knowing exactly what's going on at these fusion centers and getting some transparency.
Ask now to Matt Calabrew to talk a little bit more about some of the, you're going to talk about legislation that's happening.